We are doing some incredible work today. We are talking about all the anxiety that people have because of the rate of change. And the person who is very well situated to discuss this with me is Audrey McGibbon. Welcome to the show, Audrey.
Hi, George. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good, thanks. Now, look, there is so many things that there are. So first of all, learn to conjugate your verbs. There are so many things that people are anxious about with regards to change and the rate at which change is happening. How do we sort of calm ourselves, maybe calm our staff, calm our children when it comes to anxiety and the rate at which the world is moving?
Oh, that's a big question.
In 10 seconds or less. Thanks, Audrey.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, so the brain is primed to detect things that are threatening to us. And what is happening essentially is that we're scanning the environment the whole time, looking for things that could jeopardize us. And so in a workplace environment or in just this fast-changing world, our brains are telling us, oh, my God, everything just about is a potential threat to us. And so it's about talking yourself down through that. It's about you doing that or other people helping you do it, essentially, to calm and soothe. So everybody knows about the fight and flight response, I think.
Yeah.
But there is an alternative response that is rest and digest.
I like that. And digest. I like that. I was given that a little tip, not that dissimilar, I guess, when I was about 9 and very, very anxious. I thought I had a calling to be a nun. It's a whole thing. But I was terrified. I couldn't resist the call because, you know, God, Catholic, anyway, all that. I was about to make my first communion.
That would do it to you.
That was it. That was done. But a lovely lady said, feel gravity pulling you to the earth's core when you get into bed, and just the certainty of that it will never go away. That force will always pull you down onto your mattress and you'll be comfy and safe. And it was very helpful, but it sort of sits along with rest and digest, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's grounding. It's literally so that feeling of sinking into your bed, or, you know, in mindfulness and meditation practices now, we often sort of, you know, talk about letting your sort of worries leave your body through your feet. You know, you feel them come out, you plant on the ground, you stand firm. So that groundedness, so what we're trying to do is to sort of downregulate, to calm ourselves, because instead of staying in top gear where we're, you know, not to use these words casually, but, you know, on the verge of manic.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, everything is full on. Just how do you come down a few gears and go, you know what, I don't need to be driving in top gear at full speed the whole time.
No, and in fact, I will crash my car if I do that.
And Yeah. But I guess there's different types of anxieties. And some is about, you know, fearing the worst and catastrophizing what's going to happen to us in life. I'm going to get sacked, or I'm going to lose my job, I'm going to be homeless, or I'm going to die. You know, there's a whole heap of...
I've been through all those just this morning. Yeah, I mean, this is the last 8 minutes. And that, I mean, I think there is a genetic thing too, isn't there, with anxious people, that you can be born with a sort of more highly, you know, sensitized to, I don't know, loud noises or change of plans, or, you know, with looking at the four people I made, two of them are very relaxed and two of them are so much more like me, and I really breaks my heart for them. But there can be a genetic predisposition, can't there?
Yeah, the family history definitely plays a part, but it's sort of that whole nature-nurture debate. Just because you may have a family history of anxiety doesn't mean to say that you will definitely also have it, but the probability is higher, but it's not automatic. And likewise, the absence of anxiety in your family doesn't mean to say it isn't going to strike you. And probably some of the examples of that would be, you know, what we saw coming out of lockdowns with the increase in social anxiety really going through the roof for people that might not otherwise have had any sort
fear
of concept of.
Yeah, well, it hit me. I'd never been a socially anxious person, but I did find it very hard to go out again. It was a very strange, I mean, even now, I think, you know, why would I leave the house when I'm, here. I've got, you know, I've got TV and I've got, you know.
There's nothing threatening you.
There's nothing threatening me. And did we just lose the skill, or was it the confidence, or what happened with those couple of years of social? And I know it varies depending on where you're listening to this from, but in Victoria it was very pronounced.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I mean, what happens?
What happens to
us? Lots of things happen. I mean, it's a versional of use it or lose it. So what we know is people who sit behind screens for long periods of time are then more likely
to be virgins.
To be reluctant to engage socially. What did you say?
To be virgins. Yeah, but it's true. It's there's always been that trope, right, of like the geeky guy sitting in front of his computer all day and lamenting the fact that he hasn't got a girlfriend. You're like, well, dude, she's not going to jump out of the screen. You know, you do have to actually get up and move. But and I'm a very sociable person, doing stand-up comedy, been a teacher, like lots of people around me. But in post-COVID, I felt anxious. I went out to things and I don't know what to say. I don't know how to talk to these people. And I observed it in other people. One of my friends started sort of taking photos. I was like, what's with this photo-taking thing? She's like, I think it's a prop. I think I'm doing it to create a distance between me and other people because, I don't know how to just chat.
Yeah, and I think there's a distinction between something that makes us feel a bit nervous or uncomfortable because we're out of sort of practice doing it. So that's a sort of a normal nervousness, and you get over it or you settle into it and you get back on the horse and it's all okay. Whereas an anxiety, and particularly a social anxiety in the sort of clinical sense, is really sort of quite an intense thing. It's not fleeting. It doesn't really settle. It's something that you would know to be true of yourself at least for 6 months. It's pretty pervasive. You know, it's really a very unpleasant experience for that individual, as opposed to going either I can't really be faffed going because it's much more comfy.
Oh yeah, okay, I see. So yeah, one is like a pathological sense of discomfort and you really feel it. You're not just saying, oh, you know what, it's raining, I just may as well just stay here. I'm sort of indifferent as opposed to terrified.
Yeah, that's so terrified. So terrified rather than pathological, because social anxiety is actually, you know, if you're going to have anything, have social anxiety, because while it's extremely distressing and unpleasant, the probability of treatment being effective is actually quite high. It's one of the most, I won't say easily treated, but you know what I mean.
What is it exposure therapy? What is the cure?
Essentially. Avoidance makes it worse, actually, then facing into something that is really unpleasant is hard. So it would be about getting some sort of therapeutic support, usually using principles of cognitive behavioral therapy. Oh, we're both going to be socially anxious now about what faux pas we've made on the radio live. Cognitive behavioral therapy is just getting your thoughts laddered down. So coming down through the gears and saying, well, you know what? I think they're all going to think I'm a complete novice, or they're going to see that I'm sweating and trembling and I can't get my words out. Yeah. So all these imperfections that we see in ourselves become really, really huge in our minds. And if you go to see a psychologist skilled in cognitive behavioral therapy, they will help you challenge some of those really unhelpful thoughts that in the case of social anxiety are often not just unhelpful, but also unrealistic, actually. People in the audience are very seldom sitting there going, oh my God, she is so hopeless.
Oh,
if
no.
they're judging you, it's more likely to be empathy going, oh my God, poor George, you know, she really messed up. What a nightmare, you know, I can see she's not having fun up there. But that almost makes sort of the embarrassment worse. So social anxiety is about like just the fear of being ashamed of yourself or embarrassed about that scrutiny that others are going to put you under.
Yeah, and so with it makes it, you tell yourself a story that's completely not true, which is that everybody's looking and invested. And one of the tricks that I used to use with my kids if they're nervous was like, can you remember what that kid was wearing at the last party? And of course, no, because everyone's completely got their heads up their own bums. Look, we've got to take a little break, but I want to come back to you and talk about the correlation between perfectionism and social anxiety and how they are related. if at all. George McEncrow with your wonderful guest, Audrey McGibbon, who is she's the co-founder of Eek and Sense and an occupational psychologist, executive coach and wellbeing expert.